Hello there. This is Eric Sinrod, partner at Duane Morris in San Francisco, joined by my partner in the UK, Jonathan Armstrong, and we're here with your weekly Tech Law 10 podcast. And Jonathan, we're now amidst all the hoopla and pageantry and competition of the Olympics, and thank you kindly, sir, for hosting the Olympics for us in your town of London. But I understand there's been a fast-breaking internet legal issue that's somehow come out of the Olympics, and perhaps you can enlighten us a little bit.
Yeah, thank you, Eric, and yeah, we're pleased to host the Olympics. I think it's been a great show so far, and thank you, world, for tuning in. But we have had a very unfortunate incident this morning concerning a young British diver called Tom Daley. Tom Daley is something of a pinup over here. He competed in the Beijing Olympics when he was only 14, but unfortunately, Tom's inspiration, if you like, his father died of a brain tumor, and Tom's battled through it to get in the Olympics team again, and he's competing in the individual diving and in the synchronized diving, and he took place in that yesterday. He started off with his diving partner in first position, but regrettably they missed a medal and came fourth. And a particularly sad individual then started abusing Tom on Twitter, telling him initially that he'd let his father down and that he hadn't effectively, you know, his father would be watching and would be ashamed of his performance. And then the tweets get more aggressive, really, to Daley and to some supporters. Tom Daley had retweeted one of the messages. So a number of Daley supporters then attacked on Twitter the individual concerned, who, it's fair to say, lost the plot, if he ever had it, started abusing other people and threatened to go and get hold of Daley and drown him in a swimming pool. It turns out that the individual concerned was traced by the police to a boarding house in Weymouth. Weymouth is significant because the Olympic rowing, the Olympic sailing events are taking place there. And it seemed that possibly the individual concerned had picked other victims in the past. So obviously he's making threats to seriously harm people on Twitter, and he's close to an Olympic venue. Not unreasonably, I think, the police knocked on this individual's door and arrested him, and he's been arrested for sending malicious communications. You might remember, Eric, we talked about the Ched Evans case previously in the UK, and that's they were the arrests were made under the same legislation. So it seems to me it's a sad tale, but I think we said originally that this is obviously the first Twitter Olympics in some respects. We've already seen athletes sent home because of the way in which they've used Twitter during the Olympics. But this is obviously a sad side to the Olympics, that people think that they know the competitors so well that they can react to their performances, good or bad, instantly. In the UK, there's been a bit of a furore this morning, and I was asked to go on a BBC program where it was put to me that this was an erosion of freedom of speech. But my view, I don't know whether you share it, Eric, is we've never had freedom of speech which has enabled you to go and threaten to kill somebody, nor have we had freedom to say very hurtful things. As you know, Eric, my brother died of a brain tumor. I know how sensitive this is, and I know if you want to hurt somebody, that's something that you would mention. So I'm on the side of the police on this one, but I was interested in a juxtaposition with a case in the US this week as well, I think, where a UK company, Northcliffe, has tried to use the US courts to try and clamp down on things that are being said about, and that maybe is more directly impinging on free speech than the Tom Daley case. Is that right, Eric?
Well, I mean, I think you raise an important point, generally speaking, how much freedom does one have of speech, online and on the Internet? And as I sometimes say to people, our country, at least the United States, is all about speech and a little bit about little less about privacy. There are greater privacy protections in Europe than here, but we certainly want to be able to talk at you, and that's why we have it built into our Constitution in the First Amendment, freedom of speech. But it only goes so far, and even though people do have a right to speak freely on the Internet and anonymously, to the extent they do so and they hurt other people, there can be repercussions. And so here, if somebody says something false and it causes actual harm, you know, that's actionable under the law. And the question is, how do you go after somebody? Because so much of what is posted is done under pseudonyms. It's done anonymously. People don't want to be traced. And so what we've seen here, and I think this is also happening in this Northcliffe case, where somebody will say something online that's harmful, and then what happens is the person who's been harmed will seek to unmask the poster. And so they'll subpoena the Internet service provider and say, look, I need you to turn over to me the true identity of the person who said this online that caused me harm. And here in the United States, if a subpoena is issued to an ISP and the subpoena is not challenged, the ISP then will comply with the subpoena and provide the identity. And once the identity is supplied, the person who's been harmed can then file an actual lawsuit seeking recompense for the defamation. However, it's not uncommon. I mean, the ISP does have a duty to provide notice to the otherwise anonymous Internet poster saying, look, we're about to turn over your identity. It's in your hands. And so oftentimes the anonymous poster will have an attorney file a motion to quash the subpoena on behalf of the anonymous poster saying, look, this person has a freedom of speech right. They shouldn't be unmasked. At that point, a court is called upon to evaluate or balance the free speech interest versus the interest in protecting, well, the interest in somebody being able to speak anonymously online versus the harm that's been caused by somebody because of that speech. And we have what's called the Dendrite test here that comes from a case that was decided in New Jersey. It was one of the first cases. But essentially, if the person who's been harmed up front can put on what's called a prima facie showing that indeed they've been harmed, there's been cause and effect, harm by the speech, then the court will deny the motion to quash the subpoena. The subpoena issues, the identity is revealed, and the lawsuit goes on in terms of the defamation. I've been on both sides of the issues. I've filed motions to quash myself, and I've actually protected the identity of people where I've been able to prove that whatever was said online either wasn't false or it didn't actually cause harm. And I've also been on the side of the person who's been harmed, and I've been able to unmask Internet communicators who have said something false that have caused harm. Hope that's not a long-winded answer to your short question, Jonathan.
No, very illuminating. I think the process here would actually be broadly similar. These days, on a number of occasions, ISPs will invite the court to make an order rather than voluntarily give the information. But I think the court would apply a very similar test to the test that you've described. So there is still some similarity despite our differences in the law, I think.
Well, that's right.
So let's hope this is one of the last incidents of an athlete being abused over Twitter, but I somehow suspect it won't be.
Well, we've had our own little battle here. You might recall the famous U.S., we call soccer player, but you'd call football player, a woman named by the name of Brandi Chastain, and she was part of the gold medal team of whatever, how many years ago, 12, 16 years ago, for the United States, and she's now a commentator, and we have our goalie, Hope Solo, who's world famous, probably, and I believe that Brandi Chastain, as a commentator, was reporting on one of the matches, and she essentially was saying that Hope Solo could learn a little bit more about defense. Then Hope Solo went online and essentially said to Brandi Chastain, you know, you shouldn't comment on things you don't know about, and it caused a minor uproar over here. I don't think there are any real legal issues there. They're disagreeing on proper soccer defense. As you say, we're sort of in the first Twitter Olympics. This is being covered in so many ways, and people have many different comments, and hopefully proper netiquette will be observed.
I hope so. And just FYI, we haven't heard of Hope Solo, but we have heard of her brother Hans. So this has been Tech Law 10 for this week. We'd dearly love you to get in touch with any comments you've got, whether you agree or disagree with what Eric and I have said about those two cases. You can contact us via email, jparmstrong@dwaynemorris.com. And Eric, why don't you give your email address and then take us home to the hills, as I believe you say in the U.S.
I say take us home. I'm Eric Sinrod at ejsinrod@dwaynemorris.com. You can find both of us on Facebook, LinkedIn, Twitter. You can participate in our Tech Law 10 page on LinkedIn and talk to us. And otherwise, let's hope the United States and perhaps also the U.K. rack up a number of medals at the Olympics. Thank you for joining us this week.
Thank you. Bye now.